It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, grow your friendship circle with people older or younger than you. We'll talk about intergenerational friendship, and you could share your stories. First, a new report highlights the racial housing divide in the United States. According to an analysis by the company Clever Real Estate, houses in predominantly white neighborhoods are worth more than double those in black-majority zip codes. In metro Milwaukee, the gap is even bigger. Home values in mainly white areas are worth an average of $470,000. In predominantly black neighborhoods, homes are worth a little more than $97,000, or nearly five times less. That's the sixth biggest gap in the country. In addition, the report found that black households in America have less than one-tenth of the wealth of white households. Our next guest says we need to work to close the housing and wealth gaps, and that doing so would benefit everybody. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think of these findings. Are you surprised or not? Do you live in a black majority neighborhood? What do you think it would take to close the housing and wealth gaps? How hard has it been to buy a house and get it at a decent rate where you live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Michelle Delgado is a content writer and research analyst with Clever Real Estate, co-author of the new report. Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I gave some of the basic findings nationwide and in our biggest metropolitan area in the state there. Can you tell us a little more about that? What kind of things did you discover when you compared white majority areas and black majority areas when it came to household values?
Yeah, well, what we found was just really sweeping inequality across the board. These are things that we controlled for other factors, looking at really just limiting it to differences in race. And what we found was that even down to the price per square foot, there are these just absolutely unignorable differences between black and white households. So some of the numbers that you cited are some of our most striking findings. Other things that really stood out were, if you were looking at that price per square foot metric, in predominantly white zip codes, you would be looking at almost $200 per square foot compared to just $115 per square foot in predominantly black zip codes. And as the percentage of black residents increases, you actually can see the property values decrease. So these are just really alarming, really striking findings that I think really speak to the urgency of this issue.
We've talked about related issues on the show before, and there's a lot of history leading to where we are now. But can you talk about some of the main factors that contribute, as you see it, to that big difference you're talking about?
Absolutely. Well, like you said, these problems are really entrenched in many systems throughout the United States. Things like disparities in pay and disparities in job opportunities obviously really contribute to this problem. Something that else that I think we don't think about as much is differences in things like interest rates. So, for example, a 2015 study found that Black borrowers actually pay more interest on their loans, and these higher rates actually cost them around $765 million more per year. So you can imagine how even these factors, like taking out a loan and having to pay more to use that money, that just takes away the opportunity to put that money toward things like paying down debt, saving, spending in your local economy, or just generally having the opportunity to thrive. And it's really easy to understand once you see all of these factors adding up, how the typical Black family has, such a small percentage of household wealth compared to white families in America. These factors just layer on top of each other and really worsen the problem.
And we might hope, even if people looked at these numbers and say, okay, that's bad, we might hope that they'd been improving over time. But as I'm reading your report anyway and looking at the charts, things actually took a turn for the worse after the Great Recession in 2008. What did we see happen then?
Yes, unfortunately, in the Midwest, there was a moment in certain areas where it looked like things were getting better. And then when the crash happened in 2008, unfortunately, Black majority zip codes just did not recover at the same rates that white majority zip codes did. It actually worsened the gap. So, for example, in 2004, homes in Midwestern non-Black majority zip codes, so predominantly white areas, were worth around $76,000 more. But in 2020, that's actually widened to $116,000 more. So, it's really just gotten, the crash really exacerbated these issues. And there's even a study that came out last July from the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee Center for Economic Development that stated that Milwaukee actually ranks near the bottom against other metropolitan areas. And they even went so far as to say that it's worse off now than it was 40 or 50 years ago. It's a huge challenge that unfortunately has not gotten better over time. It really needs to be addressed head on.
Talking to Michelle Delgado with Clever Real Estate, co-author of a new report from the company looking at racial gaps in home values and household income. Big around the country, bigger in the Milwaukee metropolitan area, the sixth biggest disparities in metro areas around the country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this firsthand yourself as a homeowner or would-be homeowner in the state, maybe in that Milwaukee metro area yourself? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The Biden administration announced this week that it's taking steps aimed at reducing this racial wealth gap that includes addressing inequity in home appraisals, or rules against housing discrimination, boosting federal contracting with, quote, small disadvantaged businesses. Here is President Biden speaking in Tulsa.
Does anyone doubt this whole nation will be better off with these investments? The rich will be just as well off. The middle class will do better, and everybody will do better. It's about good-paying jobs, financial stability, and being able to build some generational wealth. It's about economic growth for our country and outcompeting the rest of the world, which is now outcompeting us.
I want to key on that one phrase, generational wealth, Michelle. And for a lot of Americans over time, often middle-class Americans, the appreciation of housing value has been something people can borrow on for job training, college for kids, you name it. How important is the value of households and this gap to an overall wealth gap in the country?
Yeah, well, like you said, the value of your assets really does influence the other opportunities that may be available to you. And in America, one of the most important aspects of your household wealth is tied up in your home's value. So to see, first of all, Black home buyers be less able to get, you know, loans in the first place to purchase homes, to see Black homeowners not have their homes appreciate at the same rates, it just really over time compounds and exacerbates that gap that we've been talking about. So I think it's a really essential thing to address, like President Biden said. And, you know, also I wanted to highlight the point that that was in that quote about the economy. Obviously, closing the racial wealth gap is the right thing to do. It's really important in this, and you know, it's very important to have equal opportunities for everyone in this country. But also, it's enormously important for the economy. It could add up to $1.5 trillion to our economy, according to some estimates. So this is a huge, huge missed opportunity that could really strengthen the country overall.
And one of the issues there, you mentioned racial gaps in interest rates for mortgages. The Biden plan also involves inequity in home appraisals. People may have seen a viral story that came out of Indianapolis. A Black homeowner got low appraisal, brought in white friends to meet the inspector and got a higher appraisal. Unequal appraisal of homes really a problem? Is this part contributing to this racial gap?
Absolutely. I think unconscious bias, or even conscious bias in some cases, can really have an impact at every level of our society. People in some cases might not even be aware that they're perpetuating these systems, but it's really crucial to bring awareness to the issue and also create enforcement around these federal requirements. The Fair Housing Act is a step in the right direction, but it obviously has not been effective in resolving the racial wealth gap or housing inequality. So one thing the Biden administration had mentioned last week in the fact sheet that the White House published was plans to strengthen enforcement of housing discrimination laws. So, you know, remains to be seen exactly what the effect will be, but it's hopefully a step in the right direction.
We're looking at an inequality in America's housing markets and a racial wealth gap with Michelle Delgado. She's a research analyst and content writer with the company Clever Real Estate. They have a new report out showing big gaps in housing values between mainly black and mainly white neighborhoods. Milwaukee metropolitan area, one of the sixth biggest, or is the sixth biggest gap among metro areas in the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this report? What's your reaction to the news? Surprise to you? Not surprising at all to you? If you live in a black majority neighborhood in the Milwaukee metro area or elsewhere, what do you see where you are? What do you think would need to change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at a new report on America's housing market. The company Clever Real Estate found that houses in mostly white areas worth more than twice as much as homes in black neighborhoods. Milwaukee metro area, homes in white areas worth nearly five times as much as those in predominantly black neighborhoods. Milwaukee's housing gap is the sixth biggest in the nation, kind of no matter how you slice it, even if you go by price per square foot. Michelle Delgado is co-author of that report. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your comments, what, if anything, you think needs to change. Michelle, your report points toward one organization working on some of these issues, a group called Dream Builders for Equity. Can you talk about some of their efforts?
So Clever Real Estate is based in St. Louis, and so is Dream Builders for Equity. They're our neighbors. St. Louis, in their predominantly black neighborhoods, has numerous vacant homes that are in desperate need of revitalization. And so Dream Builders is a 501(c) organization that really focuses on bringing neighborhood revitalization to St. Louis, employing underserved youth, hiring minority contractors, and basically offering meaningful jobs and skill building opportunities, as well as restoring the vitality of these neighborhoods. So we're really excited about the work that they're doing. They're currently raising money to purchase 25 homes in the area. And they're really just doing a lot to create public dialogue around this issue and take meaningful action to close the racial wealth gap in their community.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Sam, I'm not surprised at all at this report. I was involved about 50 years ago with a group of churches around Washington, D.C., that started a program called Home Buyers, because they saw this problem in D.C. And they would go in and with the power of 10, 12, 14, 18, 20 churches and their buying power, they would go into inner city neighborhoods, predominantly black, and purchase homes that were for sale and renovate them, hiring minority contractors. They would use the first black-owned savings loan lending institution in Washington, D.C. at the time to support a black-owned bank. They worked with all local people to renovate these homes and then sell them back at a reasonable interest rate with a reasonable down payment so that more and more black families could own their own homes and stay in their homes. Now, these were mostly white churches from the suburbs, but they saw the need and they got involved. So maybe this is something that some of the listeners who live in the Milwaukee suburbs would like to get involved in. By the way, the director of this program was just honored at the White House by Vice President Kamala Harris. So these programs work, and I just thought your audience would like to know about them.
Martha, thanks a lot for the call and sharing that story. Michelle, what do you think? It sounds like there's some overlap among what these church groups are doing and what you were talking about with the Dream Builders group in St. Louis.
Absolutely. And that's something that Dream Builders are really, really passionate about. The fact that this approach is not simple to pull off, but it's simple in concept. It's something that is applicable in any metro area and any community that is experiencing housing inequality, which, as we know, is pretty much everywhere. And one other thing that they also are able to do is when the home actually sells, they give the students who are working on these homes equity in the property. So the students will receive a portion of the profits in the form of a scholarship. So there's lots of creative ways you can reinvest in the community, lots of creative ways you can make sure that that capital from those home sales is just going right back into the community that made it happen. And yes, I completely agree. I think programs like this can work anywhere there's the will to make them happen.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Mary in New Berlin. Mary, hi.
Hi there. I was in a meeting back when I was working, and a woman came in and talked to us. And she had the one thing that stuck out in my mind that I couldn't lose was that after World War II, GIs of color did not qualify for the GI Bill. And I thought, that can't be true. My country wouldn't do that. And the research I've done says, yeah, that was true.
Right. Thanks for that call. And as I understand it, Black service members weren't specifically barred from the GI Bill, but in effect, they couldn't use it for things like home buying because they were barred from most neighborhoods in a lot of ways. Michelle, people point to that as one of the reasons for differences in generational wealth and some of the racial gap in housing and wealth today. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, going back to Tulsa, which is where President Biden made the speech this week, that's a community where a white mob destroyed an affluent Black neighborhood. And then because of redlining, the residents of that neighborhood were not able to rebuild their homes and live there again. So this happens all the time. It's very widespread. Obviously, the practice of redlining is not legal today, but you can even hear remnants of it if you listen to landlords, for example, and real estate investors talking about rating different neighborhoods with a letter grade. These are actually systems that were used during redlining. So it's really pervasive in our language. It's really seeped into a lot of aspects of real estate. And it's going to take dedicated effort to correct this.
Thanks for that call. And Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Michelle Delgado is a content writer at Clever Real Estate. We talked to her about the company's new report on America's housing and racial inequality gaps. Among the findings, it shows that the Milwaukee metropolitan area has the sixth most inequitable housing market in the country. As parents return to work after staying home during the pandemic, many are seeking childcare. But thousands of daycares around the country have closed because of rising costs and falling enrollment. Shemaine Mills talked to a Madison childcare provider who is calling it quits following a different year that underscored many of the challenges in the industry.
Family plans sometimes alter career goals. The two aren't always in sync. For Silke O'Donnell, she was able to have both only because she became a professional childcare provider. That allowed her to raise her own kids at the same time she ran a business.
That's how I started, just being home with my own daughter.
It was a very different career than the one she trained for in Germany, where she got a degree in machining. O'Donnell still uses those skills. In fact, she made some of the wooden toys at her daycare. On this particular day, kids are drawing.
Would you like sparkly paper or would you like rainbow paper?
I sparkly. Rainbow.
Rainbow?
I sparkly. Like mine? You
know what, Ryan? She opened Sunshine Family Daycare on Madison South Side in 1993. It's a working class neighborhood with a fire station nearby.
So some loud sirens going by, right?
Yeah.
I wonder where they're going.
During this conversation, 2-year-old Ryan's learning what firefighters do and why their trucks have sirens. It's what early childhood educators call a teachable moment. Just like earlier in the day when 2 Sandhill cranes strutted up the street in front of the daycare. Before her business closed permanently, O'Donnell sought to create an environment that nurtured creative thinking in the leaders of tomorrow. Kids who come from every walk of life.
I, for the past 27 years, committed half
my slots for low-income families, and my private pay families understand the importance of having their children with low-income children, because this is our real world. You know, we have such a diversity of cultures and economics.
But a lot of times, her subsidy families weren't always able to afford their copay. She waived it during the pandemic, but that hurt her bottom line.
All the other bills were still there. And the government did step in and help out with some relief. There were a couple months where they automatically put the money in our account. The parents didn't have to do that.
But she said the extra money from the federal government didn't cover the full cost of care, and that played into her decision to close the daycare this spring. Childcare in the U.S. was already a system that didn't really work well for anyone. It's expensive for parents, and providers on thin margins struggle to pay workers. The pandemic made it worse. President Biden's American Families Plan includes a $3,000 child tax credit for working parents and a $15 an hour wage for childcare workers. Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan has been touting the plan in Wisconsin.
Some people aren't coming back into the workforce for childcare issues. And don't forget, a lot of childcare providers, including someone who I know, a friend of ours personally, isn't in the business right now because it wasn't easy to do it during COVID.
And that means parents trying to get back to work have fewer people like O'Donnell to rely on. In Dane County, the most recent data shows 4% of daycares have closed. That's a far cry from last April when 40% of childcare centers in Wisconsin were shuttered, according to Department of Children and Family Secretary Emily Amundson.
So we're almost back to where we were pre-pandemic. That's a really great place to be. We're at about 5% closure rate across the state.
But even before the pandemic, childcare was in short supply. For those who kept operating, like O'Donnell, there were added expenses to keep staff and kids safe. Plus, her husband, a smoker with delicate lungs, and their teenage daughter temporarily moved to the family cabin, so O'Donnell didn't see them regularly. It was hard, she said.
I don't remember once any of my families ever saying, "How are you holding up?" Because they had so much to deal with themselves and their worries. So that was a little sad for me. You know, we are the caregivers, but who cares for us?
O'Donnell wasn't planning to retire this year, but did so at the end of May, calling 2020 the toughest year of a long career in childcare. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, it's good to surround yourself with different kinds of people. So how about people of different ages? We'll talk to a guest about befriending someone much older or younger than you. And you could join in with your stories of intergenerational friendships and what they've meant in your life. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, what happens when you call 911? Kate Archer-Kent gets a behind-the-scenes look at a Wisconsin county's emergency dispatch system. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we've learned on the show in the past that friendship can take a lot of different forms, from best friends to friends maybe you only do one specific activity with, like meeting to play a sport. What if we expanded our idea of friendship even more to consider something we might not normally think about, being friends with someone from a different generation, someone older or younger than ourselves? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have intergenerational friendships, friends who are significantly older or younger than you? How did you meet? Why do you like being friends with people from different age groups? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ellen Lem is professor of English and honors program coordinator at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at Waukesha. She's the author of the book Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show for this really interesting topic.
Well, what do you think are some of the benefits to having friendships with people who are, you know, not in our own age cohort?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a really good question. And I went today just to get some ideas thinking about it to the website of the Eisner Foundation. And that's really, they really emphasize intergenerational relationships. And there was a quote that really struck me is that sometimes it's a good way to find one's kindred spirit. And I just thought that was a really good beginning way to start the conversation is that we are so often trained to think of that the only people that we'll have someone in common with will be people our own age. And yet, you know, you can look around at people who have the same age and realize that that is no indication. So I think instead matching up with people of common interest can be really rich, as well as there's just a lot of studies on the benefits both for the old and for the young in terms of finding this kind of connection, especially as people experience loneliness, both young and old.
We've heard on the show in the past that people have a hard time sometimes finding friends, period. Can you talk about how hard it could be to find friends maybe of different age groups who we might not normally run into in the social activities, say, that we do on a regular basis?
Right. I mean, I think it really takes first just opening up one's eyes and perspective, because they do feel as if we're all sort of trained to our age group alone. And so, for example, instead of just thinking of, you know, I could only be friends with somebody who is of my same age group, expanding that. For example, I started doing a water Tai Chi class with my mom at the YMCA, and it is mostly seniors who are in there. But once I was in the water and started talking to people, we formed all kinds of connections. And now I see somebody coming to class who's pregnant, and we're of all different, you know, backgrounds and ages. And it really is taking those blinders off that we self-impose that says either this activity is only for this age or this person and I must not have anything in common because, you know, we're clearly of different generations. So some of it is, you know, individuals have to do on their own and, you know, pursue what they love without thinking about age being attached to it.
I know you watch pop culture a lot for how it portrays older people in particular. I want to give a listen to a new show from HBO. It's getting a lot of buzz. I don't have HBO. I haven't seen it. It's called Hacks, and it includes main characters with an intergenerational, I don't know if it's a friendship, at least at the start, but intergenerational
<They're working on it.
laughs> relationship. Yeah, here's a listen.
You see that antique shop there?
Yeah.
Okay, I want you to go in there, and I want you to buy this for me.
I'm sorry, what is that?
That is a Jean Royer pepper shaker, and I want it. But I can't go in. He'll gouge me. You'll get a much better deal.
My God. That's why we drove all the way out here. You didn't want to spend time getting to know each other. You just wanted a pepper shaker mule.
Bit of a non-traditional work relationship. But workplaces are one place where at least sometimes we interact with people from different generations. Can that be a good meeting starter, a good intergenerational friendship finder?
Yeah, absolutely. In different ways. I remember a couple years ago when I was teaching a class on aging and my students had to interview somebody who was in their 70s or 80s. And one of my students said she worked at a bar and she said didn't have any relatives. And she said, well, I'm really friendly with this regular customer. Can I interview him? And I said, absolutely. So, you know, sometimes it's, you know, whether one person is working, the other is a regular. But since now we have people over 65 in the workplace like never before, there are all kinds of opportunities. I know my son worked in Madison at the Union in the there was an art studio there, and that his coworkers were you know, many decades older than himself. But I think that there are interesting connections that can come from the workplace. So I agree. I think that that's an excellent starting place.
Talking to Ellen Lem from UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, looking at intergenerational friendships. You can join in with your stories, experiences, maybe at 800-642-1234. A lot of you are calling in, so let's hear from you now. Lisa starts us off in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, and I just wanted to share that when we lived in England, I volunteered with an organization called Age UK, and we matched up with an elderly individual in the community who maybe didn't have family or couldn't get out. And I was in my mid-40s, and I was matched up with the most amazing woman in her 90s, telling me stories about living through the bombing of London and going into the underground, her philosophy of life, and the things that I learned from her have really propelled me to continue to maintain friendships with older people when we moved back to the States. And I just found it invaluable and, you know, a wonderful experience.
Lisa, did you manage to find a similar matchmaking service in the U.S., or did you have to do some of the legwork on your own?
I did the legwork on my own, but I've often thought it would be something I've thought about starting and looking into establishing, because it really was such an amazing experience.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Lisa. Ellen, so she in England found, in the UK, found a matchmaking service to actually intentionally help build these intergenerational friendships. Good idea?
Oh, I think it's an excellent idea. And I do know that there are organizations. I know there's something called Newbridge here that does that kind of match up. And what I love what Lisa shared was that oftentimes that people have an idea of, like, oh, I'm going to volunteer and help the elderly, I'm going to help someone older by volunteering. But what her experience indicates, and I think a lot of people as well, it's a reciprocal relationship that the person who is maybe younger and, you know, may be doing it at first, like out of the goodness of their heart to perhaps, you know, be with people who have less company, but the riches that they take in terms of hearing those stories and learning from their experience is just really invaluable.
Thanks for that call, Lisa, at 800-642-1234. Let's hear now from AJ in Eau Claire. AJ, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, I am really glad you guys are putting on this program. So I've always tried to make friends that are older than me just because they are much smarter than me, and I love to learn from other people's experiences. At one point in my life, in like the last decade, I needed short-term housing. And so I just on a whim put a request out for housing on Craigslist and was answered by this older person. He's 67 now, and I was very reluctant at the time, but he rented out rooms in his house. And it was supposed to be just 2 weeks that I would rent from him. But I ended up staying with him and the other people that he rented from for 2.5 years.
Wow.
And we became such good friends and have vacationed together. And he is the most important person in my life, and actually walked me down the aisle last summer.
Aww.
And so, it's just really important to go outside of your comfort zone and learn things from people that have lived experiences and want to get to know you.
Wow. AJ, thank you so much for sharing that. 2 weeks ended up being 2.5 years and getting walked down the aisle, Ellen.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic story. And I really like, too, the way that you put it, AJ, about, you know, your first impression was like, oh, this is strange or this is odd, you know, which is what a lot of us have been trained to believe. Like, oh, you know, this person is like outside of my comfort zone, exactly as you put. But once you can get past that, there is sort of infinite possibilities of connection. And I'm so glad that that individual had the idea to put the room for rent and that, you know, you found each other. It seems like it was really kind of a moment of fate, but both of you also just being willing to open up your boundaries of what normally conventional friendship looks like.
Thanks so much for that call, AJ. And bringing things back to pop culture, Ellen, I mean, that sounds like a pitch for a sitcom almost.
Right.
And I know you have concerns about the way aging and older people are portrayed in popular culture. What are some of the red flags you worry about when we watch a show where, you know, a sitcom writer might have taken that scenario?
Right. Well, I do. It did come up in, I'm thinking of the Betty White TV show, that was something in Cincinnati. It's not one that I've studied, but I know a little bit about Betty White. And oftentimes when older people are portrayed on TV and movies, it's often with exaggerated characteristics. They're made into be comical. And it's like really hard to tell sometimes, are we laughing with them? Are we laughing at them? And so that's one problem. Another one is like that setting up sort of a generational antagonism. There's a show that came out recently called The Politician, and in it, Judith Light plays somebody running for Senate, Dee Dee Standish, and she's challenged by a young NYU student. And there's just so much antagonism between young and old, and the jokes fly. And I just feel as if that doesn't help us, that that's going to perpetuate those stereotypes that people who are in different age categories have nothing in common.
We're talking to Ellen Lam, professor of English and the Honors Program Coordinator at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha. She's the author of the book Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. We're talking now about intergenerational friendships, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you also have an experience to share of a friendship with someone from a different age group, 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our talk now with Ellen Lam, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, author of the book Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. We're talking about intergenerational friendships, and you could join in to share your own stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Stevens Point. Jim, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. In Stevens Point at the university, the radio station is run by students and has students hosting college alternative radio during the day. But on weekends and in the evenings, they have community volunteers that get to volunteer their talents to host shows. And I've been doing that for about 25 years, and I've been able to make friends with students at the university as well as other community volunteers. And it's been a great opportunity to make friendships with people not my age.
Jim, thanks so much for sharing that story. Ellen, volunteering can be a great opportunity to meet people, I imagine, from different age groups.
Absolutely. And, you know, in addition, just the idea of universities, they are such a great place for people to come together. Older people can audit classes oftentimes for free. I have had students in my classes, up to someone who was in his 90s, actually taking the class for credit because he had never gotten his bachelor's degree. And it really infuses a classroom to have people who have had real-world experience and come in and share their ideas. So both through volunteering and university settings, lectures in foreign arts, book festivals, those are all really great places to meet somebody outside of one's age, but with a lot of things shared in common.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. With that example of how you've met people intergenerationally, that's 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share, Ellen, you pointed us toward a new movie called Here Today about an unexpected friendship. Here's a bit of the trailer with a couple of friends-to-be, I guess, meeting in a restaurant.
Thank you for bidding on me in the auction.
I am so flattered that somebody your age would be a fan of my work.
I don't know who the hell you are. My ex really wanted to meet you, so he bid.
How much?
$22.
$2,200? That's fantastic.
$22. It started at $20, and then it went up in 50-cent increments.
Why are you pointing this toward? This sounds like fun. Why are you pointing this toward this movie, Ellen?
Well, it is an unconventional friendship. Billy Crystal plays a veteran comedy writer, a widow, who, because of sort of almost like an accidental connection through this auctioning, meets somebody who is many years younger than him and a very different profession. She's a New York street singer and played by the very talented, very funny Tiffany Haddish. And what's really neat about the movie is that While they don't seem to share much in common, it's not a case of friendship about common interests, but it is still people can find a connection. And in this movie, she is able to bond with him in a way that his family isn't, that he puts up some types of barriers. He's losing some of his mental faculties, and he is afraid to come clean with his family. But somebody who is a little bit of an outsider, who doesn't have that, but who just has a big heart, they make each other laugh, they enjoy each other's company, and he can be real with her in a way that he can't with others who look up to him as being a role model because he had this celebrated career. So I think a lot of lessons come from that movie about intergenerational friendship. And it's just newly released. I just saw it last weekend.
We're talking about friendships between generations with Ellen Lem, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha. She's the author of Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. If you have an intergenerational friendship story to share, still time for you at 800-642-1234. If you encountered a busy signal earlier, that line has opened up now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ellen, for generations, we've talked about concerns about a generation gap, inability to understand younger people understanding older people or people my age even, you can call it older, I guess, worried about kids today. How can these kind of friendships help bridge those maybe misconceptions we have about each other?
Yeah, and I think that's really what I am finding interesting about the television show Hacks, because the convention of the show is that the long diva-type comedy performer played by Jean Smart, people are feeling like, oh, her act is old. We need to bring in some, like, new talent. So they hire somebody in her 20s. And so on the surface, it seems as if, okay, we're going to have this infusion because they're so different. But despite their differences, there's so much commonality that comes across, and even in their antagonism, but so much that they share, that it really shows that these are arbitrary when we make these statements about boomer generation or the millennials are. They're sort of like creations of our own that putting up barriers that are really not necessary, because there's more that links human beings together than what separates us.
Let's go back to our callers now. Gordon is with us in La Crosse. Gordon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to call and let you know when my story is about intergenerational friendships. A neighbor of mine invited me to the Cheeseland Band, which met every week at the Moose Club in La Crosse. I went there and it was pretty crazy, about 50 people every week getting together to play ukulele. Most of them were over 60. And that turned out to be one of the most fun part of it, as being with people not of my age group, appreciating each other and each other's talents. It was pretty cool before COVID.
And hopefully you can get back to it again, Gordon. Thank you so much. Yeah, Ellen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I'm really glad with that call, because it is a reminder about our neighborhoods, too. And now that we are all sort of coming out of hibernation again after COVID and getting to see our neighbors again, I mean, neighborhoods are a great place. I know here in Waukesha, where I live, that my neighbors, you know, next door are people that have babies, and I know people on the block who are in their 80s, and we look out for each other. Those conversations that we have casually in the street are great opportunities to realize that everybody's got these stories and that are worth sharing with one another, even though we're at different points in life. So it was great to hear that neighborhood story, and, you know, with the ukulele connection about, you know, because I do think that music is a great unifier. And that's another pop culture example that won a couple of Academy Awards, was this movie Sound of Metal, about a drummer who loses his hearing, and he eventually becomes, he finds someone who's like a mentor to him who had also lost his hearing late in life and who also is in recovery from drugs and alcohol. And you really see how helpful it is that somebody who has had some experiences to help lead the way to a younger person. So that was another a really good example of intergenerational friendships.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Ellen Lem from UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, author of the book Gray Matters. She joined us to talk about intergenerational friendships. Tomorrow on Central Time, this week's edition of Food Friday, cooking with seasonal fruit. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. I think I'm a little late on this, but I planted vegetables in my little garden patch over the last few days. I say little garden patch instead of garden. If I said garden, the mental image that popped into your head would almost definitely be bigger than my small, unambitious garden zone. Like, I planted 11 plants. Every year, I plant cucumbers, zucchini, and something else. And every year, I harvest cucumbers, zucchini, and nothing else. This year's designated failures are kale and mini eggplants. The good news is I've been more successful with fruit over the years. I have an amazing rhubarb plant. It was here when I moved in. It's right next to the compost bin. I've kept it alive and thriving by doing nothing. Some of you might be thinking, technically, Rob, rhubarb isn't a fruit. My definition of fruit is you can bake it in a fruit crisp. For that definition, rhubarb is a fruit. I have a serviceberry tree that survived a marauding band of rabbits. There are berries on the way for delicious simple syrups. And I planted raspberries over the years. They don't look like much, but I always get some berries. Great news, tomorrow on Food Friday, as I mentioned, we'll have a baker joining us with some advice on baking with seasonal fruit. Maybe we should plan ahead for an eggplant cooking segment this year. I'm feeling lucky. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.